I'm speaking today with Dan Grant, who is a candidate for Congressional District 10, stretching from Travis to Harris counties. Dan, first question, what made you decide to get into this race?
Because the people of this district deserve to have a representative who actually looks after everyone in it. And then separately, I was in Iraq for a year and a half, and I went there to try and change things for the better there, and it wasn't enough. And so I decided to come back and go to the source of things and try to change them in Washington.
Okay, well, let's talk about Iraq.
Sure.
That's a bit, you know, that's a, obviously an important piece of your resume. Mm-hmm. What exactly did you do in Iraq for a year and a half?
I worked as a civilian for a nonprofit organization called IFAS, the International Foundation for Election Systems. And it's financed by the U.S. government through an act of Congress. And it is hired to work by, to do the work of the U.S. State Department through USAID, the development arm of the State Department. And essentially, real white hat, above board, no Blackwater, no intelligence agency, none of this stuff. And there's a lot of people are, you know, interested to know what a civilian would be doing going to Iraq. And this is completely the good guys in this. I went there with IFAS to go work as an advisor to the Iraqi Elections Ministry for a year and a half. And it was real nuts and bolts. Here's how you design a ballot. Here's how you register voters and maintain a voter database to help set up the logistics of the Iraqi elections. And that's what I was doing there.
What would you say then is the status of Iraqi democracy and election holding these days?
Grim at best, like everything else in Iraq. And that was one of the reasons why I decided to come back. When we held the elections, it was a success on all counts. It was they were transparent. They were held to international standards. Corruption, amazingly, was kept to a minimum that did not taint the results of the elections. But once they were complete, there was no backing for the Bush administration to continue the pressure. The Bush administration wanted photo ops. They wanted to have pictures of happy Iraqis coming out of voting booths with purple fingers for consumption back home so as to reinforce their own political power here. And they let it all fall by the wayside. And there was enormous momentum in Iraq to keep doing it. And I've had experience working in elections in other countries where the institutions of the government are shattered or the faith of the populace in the government is weak or non-existent. And elections help build that. If you can show that your voice can be heard and will be translated into representation, you are more likely to use politics and the ballot box as means of sorting out your differences rather than picking up a rifle. It was shown to be the case in Bosnia and Kosovo. You just have election after election and show that people actually have a stake in how things go and their voice will have an influence on the outcome. This was abandoned by the Bush administration. The new Iraqi government was able to consolidate its power and didn't see any point in trying to have any further elections. And the lines have hardened, and while I was there for the balance of 2006, things worsened. It became the most violent year since for the entire war, and I had friends who paid for it with their lives, other civilians, and that's why I decided to come back, because I wouldn't have it. I knew that their sacrifice was never going to be honored by the administration.
Now, of course, since then, there's been the surge.
That's right.
There has been a decrease in violence.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's your opinion of the surge?
The surge has been a failure because the reason of the surge was to create a breathing space for political accommodation to occur between the three Iraqi groups, and that has not happened. There is a lull in violence, and the reason for this is two or even threefold. First and foremost, there has been a drop in violence in Baghdad. There's been an increase of American troops brought into Baghdad, and that has helped somewhat. But the places where the American troops have left, in their absence, violence has flared up. It's like trying to nail jelly to a wall. Secondly, guys like Muqtada al-Sadr. Sadr has ordered his supporters to not engage with other Sunnis, basically to cease violence, in an attempt to wait us out. And then finally, the success of the surge has nothing to do, in many respects, with what we've done. It's been the success of violence and ethnic cleansing that has come before it. Baghdad used to be a completely mixed city, and now it is balkanized. Almost all of the mixed neighborhoods have been subject to such high levels of murder and intimidation that murder has worked. There isn't any more violence in parts of Baghdad because there is no one left to kill. There is a lull in what is going on politically and in a state of seizure. But it doesn't mean that the surge has worked. the internal fissures in Iraq that have kept everything going off the rails are still there, and they haven't gone one inch towards making any accommodation with one another. That's the surge.
So, it's 2009, you've been elected to Congress. What do you want to do about it?
I would reduce troops by 80% from the central and south of Iraq as quickly as possible. And the reason for this, as much as anything else about the political realities, is also the mathematical realities that are facing our own armed forces. We can't sustain our numbers the way we are up through about this coming summer. We've had a dramatic drop-off in retention of captains, sergeants, and lieutenants, which are the guts of any armed force. The Army can't function without them. Our recruitment levels are as low as they have been since 1973, I believe, the first year when the voluntary army started. We're going to have to start reducing our troops simply because we can't sustain it. Equipment failure, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is neither left nor right. This is just the simple constraints that's going to be placed upon what we can manage to do. With that in mind, if we do not have the troops available to force peace on Iraq, and that would take at least 500,000, and we don't have that, it would take a draft, which won't happen. Without that, we have 170,000 troops in the middle of harm's way being killed and injured a few at a time for no strategic gain in an area where we are not able to affect the outcome politically. I would remove them, redeploy 80% of them and move them out of the south and center. The remaining 30,000 I would reposition over the border to the south in Kuwait and up into Kurdistan to the north. And their purpose would be twofold. One would be as to act as a break, a bulwark on the war from spreading beyond its borders to include Turkey or, even more dangerously, Iran or Saudi Arabia. If Iran or Saudi Arabia were both looped into a regional war with Iraq, that would be half of planetary oil reserves. And if you think the recession that's coming down the pipeline now is going to be bad news, if something like that were to happen, it would cause a global depression. Secondly, though, there is a moral element to having some forces remain behind but out of harm's way. I get asked routinely, doesn't the United States have an obligation to try and fix what it helped create in Iraq? And the answer is absolutely yes, but that's not the right question to ask. It's, are we able? What are we able to actually do? If something truly ghastly, truly Rwanda level, were to occur in some mixed communities in Iraq, and there are a few that immediately spring to mind. There's a city called Kirkuk to the north, which is mixed Kurdish and Sunni and sits atop a mountain of oil. If something truly genocidal were to occur, we could have forces at the ready that could try and keep a lid on it, so that at least we could try and act according to the moral responsibility that we can. Beyond that, there is not much we can continue to do. The cost is huge in blood and treasure. Our ability to affect the outcome is nearly zero. Being cavalier and reckless is what got us into this mess. It is wise to not repeat more cavalier attitude and recklessness in repositioning ourselves. We should do it smart, but we should immediately start to change our stance in the country.
It's probably fair to say that a lot of people, a lot of Democrats especially, thought that after the 2006 election, there would be more progress made by now in getting troops out.
Yeah.
For a variety of reasons, you know, resistance from the Bush White House and the Republicans, and, you know, a failure to do more, if you will, on the part of a number of Democrats, more hasn't happened.
Right.
You know, what's your assessment of what we have done, and you know, how do you change the perception? It seems like a lot of Congress people have been afraid to do more on the grounds that it's not popular or something. How do you change what the Congress is doing?
Well, okay. Well, it's hard for me to speak as the motivations of other congressmen. I think one of the main obstacles that Congress is facing is Bush will not change his mind no matter what conditions he's in, and is happy to be as obstructionist as possible towards meeting the will of the electorate as long as he is in power. He does not care how much his popularity plummets or how badly it affects the other Republicans trying to succeed him in the presidency. I mean, that's definitely been shown. Probably children's health insurance is probably the biggest one that demonstrates that, but Iraq is certainly there. While it is said often, I think it's true, that the barring a greater number of Democrats to be able to force what they want through in the Senate and the House, there's a bit of a stalemate involved. Now, this is more of a tonal guess. My suspicion is that guys like Pelosi and Reid are concerned that it's a dangerous game of chicken to get involved with the presidency as to who is more obstructionist and who is at fault for staring down each other, for cutting off funding for the troops. Who's the one who's really causing the problems? Because it can backfire on you. I have a suspicion that starting this summer, you will start to have a great deal of aggression coming out on the part of the Democratic leadership in the House and Senate, because they figure the timing will be at its optimum to push for real change, and if it gets slapped back, to point the finger of blame at the administration. But it's very easy for the president, as the bully pulpit and a single person, to say, I want to do X, but Congress is blocking me. And it's hard for Congress to combat against that unless there is a consistent effort, and it's hard to control Congress anyway. I think my guess is timing more than anything else is one of the reasons why. But also, we don't have the numbers. We simply don't have the numbers. Once I am in Congress, I think you're going to see a great deal more proactive legislation, largely because you're going to have a Democratic president, and you're going to have a majority in the Senate and the House that's even greater than it is now, and certainly one more in the House from Texas.
All right. So let's talk about stuff more at home now.
Sure.
You represent a district that runs from Austin to Houston, basically.
That's right.
How do you represent a district like that? It's not clear that there's much in the way of, you know, community of interest from one end to the other with the little rural towns in between. How do you represent a district like that?
You represent it by listening to the constituency across from one end to the other. I've heard this question from more than one person, and it strikes me as funny because nobody asks Senate candidates or governors that. How do they represent a community that's so broadly based as Texas? It's absurd on its face. You do. You just represent them. I have a district that includes the exurbs of Harris County, urban and suburban areas of Austin, and rural districts in between. But it's my responsibility to understand my district as best as I can, listen to the concerns of everyone, and try to do as best I can as their advocate in Washington. And there are even districts that aren't gerrymandered all over the place that are huge and have mixtures like this, and congressmen represent them ably. The real point is a dedication towards really listening and doing the best that I can to act on the behalf of those that I represent. I worked for Jake Pickle when I was a young man. I interned for him, and I got to see up close what it was like for a guy who really did take it seriously to look out for everybody, Republicans and Democrats alike. His abstract sense was that, you know, this job is supposed to be the point of contact between the average citizen and the American government. If you have something that's gone wrong, if you have a grievance, if your VA loan didn't work out, if your Social Security check didn't come through, the congressman is the one who helps unstick it for you. And it doesn't matter if you live in Hempstead or Austin or Brenham or Katy.
Okay. Right now, Congress is talking about various stimulus packages to keep the economy from going off the rails. What do you think, if anything, Congress should be doing to help the current economic situation?
I think the stimulus package they put through is a good start, but it's not going to be enough. I'd be in favor of, Iraq ties into this a great deal. The amount of money that's being pumped into Iraq at this point could easily be used in greater stimulus for the economy. Secondly, I'd repeal the Bush tax cuts, or most of them, and redirect a good deal of it towards relief on the middle and working classes, because that's the engine of the economy. A recession comes and goes based on the ability of economic activity of people making less than $100,000 a year, even less than $60,000 a year. So the main thing I would do is work on repealing or allowing to expire the upper class tax cuts that got pushed through at the beginning of the Bush administration.
what, if anything, do you think Congress should do about the meltdown in the housing market nationally?
My suspicion is that Congress will probably step in and do something similar to the S&L crisis in the 80s, where they will essentially take on the role of guaranteeing that people don't lose their houses. Because if this went on to its logical conclusion without government intervention, you could have as many as, I think, 3 million people lose their homes. That won't happen. That just simply won't happen. You will have the government probably assuming the loans on the behalf of other companies that are going bankrupt that own them to make sure that you don't have masses of evictions of people going out. And it means that the public finance is going to take a hit. But versus the alternative of having mass homelessness in communities that have had the market fall out from underneath them, it's a pretty clear choice. But I mean, something like this happened with the S&Ls about in 1988, I think.
Some people have observed that one of the things that has been a consequence of the mortgage crisis was one of the effects of the bankruptcy bill, which essentially made people value paying off their credit card debt over paying off their mortgages. What would you like to see done to the bankruptcy bill, which has received a lot of criticism on other grounds since it was passed?
The bankruptcy bill was essentially a giveaway put together by the Republican Congress in its dying year in an attempt to... Let me back up. A great deal of the philosophy under the Republican Congress and the Bush administration was to treat people in the middle and working classes as a profit center for big business. And the bankruptcy bill is a perfect example of that, making it more difficult for people to declare bankruptcy, which is one of the genius elements of the American economy that helps people foster entrepreneurial work. If you can, you're more willing to take a risk if that risk won't destroy you and put you in the poorhouse forever. Credit card companies and the banks wanted to make sure that they can keep you locked forever into the debt that you acquire that you can't get out from under. Now, I also put a lot of this at the feet of cheaper credit that really should not be extended to some, and people overextend themselves. It used to be extraordinarily hard to get a credit card, and now there seems to be an insidious desire to try and extend credit to people who really should not be considered a good fit for credit, and then making it extraordinarily hard for you to declare bankruptcy if you go beyond your means. Aside from the justice of that, it's unwise for economic activity in the country. I think the bankruptcy bill should be revisited and changed radically.
There's a battle going on in South Texas over the proposed border fence. The federal government has just filed some lawsuits against some border towns who had refused to let the federal agents on to survey city property.
Yes.
Where do you stand on the issue of immigration and the border fence?
Let me start backwards. I'm against the fence. I've had the good luck of going to East Berlin. America is not in the business of building up walls. That didn't work out too well for the Soviets. I don't like it. And I don't think it would be effective, because there's the old saw that a $700 million wall will only increase the sale of $10 ladders. Also, border security is essentially fluid and police keeping. If you build a wall in one area, all it means is that attempts to cross into the country illegally will just move to where it's more porous. By that thinking, then you'd have to build a wall that stretched all the way from Texas to the Pacific Ocean. And I am interested, I'm not in favor of the wall. I don't think it's effective. Secondly, for immigration, I have noticed that in this district, people ask me rhetorically, what do I think about immigration, because it gets discussed. And I say, well, what do you think about immigration? And to a person, it has always been, I don't. I'm concerned about health care, the economy, and the war. I think in places like Iowa, which is 97% white, but had an influx of Latinos working in their slaughterhouses, immigration was a big issue because it was such a novelty. And among Republican voters in the primaries, it was of great concern in Iowa. And so all the Republican candidates constantly discussed it because it was something that would help get them votes. But it translated out to the rest of the country. In Texas, there's much more subtlety about it. It's really divided into two issues: border security and the status of illegal immigrants. And for those that wish to continue the conversation, very rarely do people ever speak about the status of illegal immigrants. They're all concerned about border security, and I am, largely because of my experiences overseas. But I'm concerned about making sure that the border is monitored less for the people who come across, but more about people from countries other than Latin America carrying who knows what. I'm concerned about chemical bombs being smuggled into the United States. And to that end, I'm in favor of increasing the Border Patrol. I want it to remain in federal hands. I want it to be coordinated out of Washington. I'm concerned mostly about the safety of this country and how the administration has been using immigration as a smokescreen issue to help paper over its incredible failures on every other front. Immigration came to the forefront in the spring of 2006 out of nowhere, when it became obvious that the Republicans were going to have their heads handed to them in the general election that fall, and they desperately needed some issue to point to galvanize the public into voting for them, and it didn't work. The good news for the Democrats is they're still using the same playbook. And if Michael McCaul decides to harp on immigration as an issue, that is an unwise decision for him, because people are more concerned about the fact that they don't have children's health insurance and that they may not be able to hang on to their jobs this summer.
Well, there's going to be an override vote on children's health insurance again.
Yes.
Congress comes close but can't quite get there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is there an what's the answer to that? More Democrats or
more Democrats? I mean, it is. This is interesting. I don't know. It is. Chip is incredibly popular. And it's incredibly popular. Republicans and Democrats, the populace, Republicans and Democrats, are absolutely in favor. It's a system that works. It helps keep your kids healthy. I think you're going to be seeing a lot of the tension within the Republican Party come this summer, where holding to the party line and being against CHIP versus what it's going to cost you in the general election come this summer, you'll start to see people breaking away. Michael McCaul receives government-subsidized health care paid for by you and me, but he does not believe that the children of Texas should receive the same sort of help. And aside from the hypocrisy of that, I'm amazed that a guy who claims to represent everyone in his district, rich and poor, and even Republican and Democrat, isn't particularly interested in making sure that children remain insured in a plan that works. But I guess it's possible that it'll be overridden in the summertime, but maybe not, and it'll be more Democrats, frankly.
You are in a contested primary for this race.
Yes.
On March 4th, why should people vote for you to be the candidate for Congressional District 10?
Okay. Because I am going to be able to beat Mike McCaul. Because I am the candidate who knows the issues, has the right ideas, and has gotten the right kind of support. I've received every endorsement from a group that has chosen to endorse up to this point. I have the backing of the last two gentlemen who ran in this race. I have the grassroots support. I have the support from people like Bernard Rappaport, who's going to be doing fundraisers for me in the spring, John Eddie Williams, Walter Umphrey, people who get the attention of the DCCC. So not only is it at the grassroots level, but where it counts in terms of money in the general is why I'm going to be able to take it to McCaul and win. I can't speak for my opponent, but in every way that matters so far, people realize that this race can be won, and I have the right story, the right sense of what needs to be done in this district, the right kind of desire to truly represent people, and the voters in District 10 have responded to that and have been supportive of me.
All right. Dan Grant, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thank you.